Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am, starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' This is the word of the Lord."
I runga te ingoe, te mātua, te tāma, me te wairo tapu. Amen. One Sunday, I came home from work, and there was a young man waiting to see me. His neighbour knew that I was a pastor, and his friend was going through a really tough time. And he said, "Well, why don't you go over and speak with Chris?" So we came on in, we sat down and shared about life. Pretty general sort of stuff for a start. I noticed he had a large tattoo around his neck with a woman's name on it. And I said, "Oh, tell me about the significance of that in your life." And he said, "Oh, that was the name of my son's mother. I really loved her, and I wanted to show her that love and to show the permanence of that love, and I had a name tattooed across my neck, but she left me. And she took my son off to Australia and cut off all contact." And for this young man, every time he looked in the mirror, it was a permanent reminder of rejection, of not having that love received that he longed for. I looked and I saw, and he had another tattoo as well. And I asked him about that one and its significance. And he said, "Oh, that's the name of a gang that I was wanting to be a part of." And he said, "I joined them, and I got that name there just to show them I belonged." And ended up they beat him severely, and they threw him out, and rejected him. Another permanent reminder of rejection and his failure to be loved every time he looked in the mirror. As the conversation went on, he slowly pulled up his sleeve and showed me the marks where he made an attempt on his life. Feeling the rejection of the world and a lack of place, a lack of belonging, a lack of love. He'd been searching for a sense of place and home and belonging and hadn't found it. And this story, though it's at the extreme end and perhaps offers more visual clues to it, it's not unique. And more than ever, people are lonely, they're isolated, and disconnected. I think we still live in a world of exile that people might know to name it that. In many ways, we're becoming even more separated. And even for those that know a sense of place or a sense of belonging, often that belonging is only found with people like us in our own echo chamber, people at the table who agree with the sorts of things we do. So it's only a partial community, really. We struggle to stay at the table with people we disagree with, or to make room at our tables for people not like us or who we don't agree with. I have to say, one of the things I've noticed already, and I commend you on, that the gift of hospitality, I think, exists in this parish. And praise God for that. And I just want to acknowledge that each day I come in here, the doors are open, and there are always multiple gatherings of table and welcome and fellowship. I just want to name that and just say, boy, that is countercultural. That's subverting the powers of the world and showing something that is different. It's my second week in sharing here. I wanted to grab hold of the second part of the parish vision statement, that your communities, we are communities creating other communities here. I want to speak into that a little bit this morning. As we do, I want to use it as an opportunity to share a little bit more of my own testimony as well, and my encounter with Jesus, and how I've recognized that play out in my own life and the importance of it. Maybe some ways that for me, that shapes how I think about mission and ministry, so you can get to know me a little bit. There's some things in it, the idea of exile and homecoming. It first involves a home leaving. I'm going to preach a little bit based on Luke 15 this morning. I'm not going to exposit the whole thing, but use it as a launch point because I think we can connect with it. Luke 15, it begins with a story of leaving. And the youngest son goes up to the father and he says, look, I want my share of the inheritance. I want you to give it to me now. I can leave. We read over, because we know that story, don't we? That's the Sunday school story. We know that that's going to happen. But do you think about that? When do you receive an inheritance? When someone dies. And so the son is going to the father and basically saying is, I would be better off if you were dead. I actually want you for what you have and can give me, not for who you are. And when the father has to go and sell the property, this is an agrarian society, it's a small town, everyone would have known, and to carve off the parcel of the land, the word actually is bios, it's life itself. Life itself is torn in two. It says, I wish you were dead, I think I'd be better off without you, and I'm going to take what you have given, and I'm going to use it for my purposes, not for yours. It's what it's saying is, it's that wages to say, actually, I think that life might be better without God. And that's at the heart of it, isn't it? When we find exile, if God is the source of life and all we have and goodness and love and our relationship comes in that relationship, who we are. And it's this wager, isn't it, that we say, actually, is God good? Is God love? Is life found in this relationship? Or perhaps there's more outside. That's the wager. Now, some of us grow up within that story, and we know and we're told of God's love. Some people have never heard that story. But for all of us, we have to come to that decision. Is that where is life found? Where is identity found? Where is purpose found? Where is meaning found? And the son wakes up one day, and he thinks life would be better out of that relationship. And if that relationship was dead to me, and I could take everything I have and use it for my means, not for God's means. I knew a call to be a priest when I was about 8 years old. I won't go into the details. I just knew that it had happened, and I didn't want it to have happened, if that makes sense. And when you're 8 years old, you don't have a whole lot to work with it, except it happened.
I was kind of angry about it and upset about the whole thing, you know. But it had happened, and I didn't really know what to do with it. And there was that sense of knowing that call on my life, but without really knowing the love of God behind that. And how can an eight-year-old in some ways? But I guess the risk is I don't want to do that. And there was a sense, really, what I was saying in there is that I don't actually trust or fully believe that you are fully good, God, and if you call me to something, that will be the path of life. There was a sense that the cost to me, the benefit might not weigh out the cost. We all have to come to that decision, don't we? Is God good? Can I trust God with my life and with God's call on my life, whatever the cost might be? And so I lived with that reality of that call, maybe the burden of that call without the understanding of God's grace or that encounter with that love. So I moved on. That happened another part of my life. I missed about 2 years off school with a back injury. So when I was about 14, I'd had a knee injury, and I don't know if it's connected in any way, but I got off my crutches, went for a run, and came home that night, and I just couldn't get up off the ground. I was just pain. I never made it back for the last half of that year of school. That would have been year 10, fourth form, as it would have been then, year 10. And that went on. I was sort of in and out of school for the next year. I missed two-thirds of the year 12 year. And of course, those are years when really you're forming, coming to an understanding of who you are and where you fit in and friendships and what you're about. I just missed it. And I felt this real sense of missing out. And, you know, when you're not at school, initially the friends come and visit you and stuff. But after a while, because you're not there, you kind of get left off to the side. And that's, I'm not blaming anyone for that. It's just, it can happen. You can get isolated. And I remember, so I walked through that. And I tell that because then when it came to leaving home, I'd missed so much of sort of the fun and that sense of community that I was off to university. And coming from a small town as well, my identity was really, oh, you're Brian Pauline Dodds' son. That was a good thing, but in a small town, that's also a thing. You know what I mean? It's a small town, and I was always judged against that. And I shared last week when it came that sense of measuring up and stuff. But I must say, when I went to university, because I hadn't had that sense of community and being able to be involved, I had massive FOMO. Fear of missing out. Man, I just came out of the gates, and there was a sense of this promise that life was found. The image or the identity of the Scarfie, or back, you know, it was from South Otago, so it's the Southern Man. You know, every time I've been to the rugby at Carisbrook, that song had sung, and it's sort of, you know, it's embedded and told to you and shaped and formed, discipled in this way, that this is what life would look like, and this is the image by which you want to become and formed into. So I'm off university with a serious FOMO and just loving it, but wrestling with the sense as well. On one hand, there's knowing call to be a priest, but without really knowing God's grace and this promise of life and its fullness that was separate. And, you know, I won't go into the long story, but when you're wrestling with that sort of stuff, it can tear you in two. On one hand, you're out there just getting smashed on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and occasionally I might rock up to church on a Sunday and my flatmates are looking as though, that's interesting. But it was this, never this, I didn't wake up one day and say, God, I wish you were dead, I want to reject. It was just, I started going where the tide was taking, where the river was going. And it was always this, is God good? Where is life found? Where is my purpose and my identity found? Like the younger son, life exists in a fuller way in the foreign land, out of the relationship with the Father. When I graduated, I still lived with that. I moved up to Wellington, and I followed a girl up there, actually. 3 days into that, it was going nowhere. And so there I am sleeping on a mate's couch and thinking, well, that's interesting. I've got this law degree and commerce degree, and I think I'd be a rubbish lawyer. And better find a way to pay the bills or something. So again, this searching, and never I guess I just never got round to going to church. There's just, you know, the mind the gap moments. And if you're not intentional, the river's going one way and the tide's going with it, you'll just flow a particular way. And that happened. You know, jobs in tourism, marketing, in the patents office. I had what I thought was my dream job. I was national director of the Enterprise Studies program. I got to travel around and work with a lot of young people. I got involved in sort of self-help stuff and got to a lot of conferences. I wrote a couple of books and I got to interview some of New Zealand's most famous people and to record their stories and put books in all of the schools in the country. And it opened up doors to speak and to encourage, but it was... And there was some good in it, there's some fascinating stories, but it was of the self-help variety. Another part of the life, I found myself owning a pub. I should note before that, I'd actually come through a period of chronic fatigue syndrome that led into an inability to work. So time off on a sickness benefit, couldn't work, couldn't walk, just rubbish, and that led to clinical depression and just a sense I no longer wanted to live. It wasn't that life would be better without God. Life would be better without me. And that was my experience there. And I had another encounter with God at that time, that same feeling of God speaking and calling me to the priesthood. In that moment, in that darkest hole, there was God speaking, calling me back to life, back towards God. And so that got my attention again. And so I went out and bought a bar. Which, if you've had chronic fatigue and stuff like that, it's probably not wise, but I really wanted to do it. And for me, that was life, right? There was this sense of, man, what could be doing this gathering together of people and this joy of people wanting to be together. And we had live music playing most nights of the week, and there was singing and sense of being together and open conversation and confession and all the stuff that goes on in the later hours. And I thought it was this experience of life because I had this community and sense around. And my younger sister, he's now her husband, came up to visit. And I thought, man, they're going to be so impressed with me, aren't they? My sister will probably be a little bit jealous just because of this life that I have. Now you're seeing just how far blind I was. But anyway, that's what I thought. And she was a Christian, and they were working with you, so she didn't drink as part of her covenant with the church that she was at. But they came both on the Friday and the Saturday night, and they hung out, and they came into the space where I was, and they showed a genuine interest. I didn't get a hint of judgment from them. They were just there because I was her brother. And so they came to be there. And at the end of the Saturday night, they said, look, we're going to church tomorrow morning. Do you want to come? And I'm thinking in my head, no, I don't. And I may not even be home by that time. Or not in a state to go. But I guess that's the sense. Well, I was invited, and I felt the sense of reciprocity. It wasn't more than that, but you came to my place, I'll go to yours, and I'll take one for the team. Anyway, they picked me up the next morning and turned up, and I walked into that place. I cannot tell you what was preached. I don't remember in that time. I walked into that place, and there was a joy or something about that community that was there that I just could not place my hand on, and yet I knew that it was different. The gathering and the people were there, the worship, the music was there, and it was very good musicianship like here, but there was something different about the object of that singing or where that was pointed to, and it struck me deeply, this joy. And there would have been a message. Jesus would have been preached, I know, in that place. And Jesus was preached. And I went along the next week on my own. And I went alone, but just it was like there's something about that place. And I walked in that door, and Bryce, I knew it, didn't know him then, he came running up to me, Chris, welcome back. It's so good to see you again. How was your week? I thought, man, if I could get my staff doing that, we could, you know, exponential growth opportunity. But it just struck me. This welcome back. Amazing. And that started a journey of walking and encountering the love of this God and to hear the gospel of Jesus. And the thing that I worked out, and I thought, actually, you know what? There is a reason why people gather in bars. There is a reason why I liked it. There is a reason. It's not all that. What I was experiencing was a shadow version of the real thing. Okay? We are created to be in community and in relationship. We are created to know joy. We are created to worship. We know our wrongdoings. There's this sense of needing to confess to someone and having someone nod and say, it'll be okay. You're acceptable. And so if we don't know the source of those things, we will find them somewhere else, because everybody is longing for community, for acceptance, to be loved, a sense of who they are, where they belong, and what they're about to do. And we can go to the one who is the source of those things, or we will find a shadow version of it, which will offer a partial part, which is why the church should not just be anti every single thing. We should recognize, why is it that that resonates in something, and what does that point in some way to the goodness of God that we can affirm because creation is good? And how might we, and the Spirit's work really, isn't it? But how can we, with that posture and in that way, point them to the source of that thing that will be truly life-giving? And that was my experience. It's interesting when we go going back to Luke 15, the younger son leaves. He says, I'd be better off without you. And he experiences exile as well, perhaps like I did, the pig pen moment, realizing that I came to a point I thought life might be better off without me in it. And he had that moment too. He comes home, and again, not going to exposit the whole text, but it's interesting when we look at Luke 15, often in our children's Bibles or Sunday school, the way we've read it, we often split it into three parables. Remember the one about the sheep, the 100 sheep and the one lost, and there's the 10 coins and the woman that looks and finds for the one lost and the two brothers. Jesus actually tells one parable. It's one story, one thing that he's getting to. And if you take a look, it starts with sheep. We think about, well, I read yesterday, there's only 4.6 million sheep. No, 4.6 sheep per person in New Zealand now. It's down from 60. But sheep, a valuable possession in that agrarian community, something incredibly valuable. So here was this person who he's talking and telling this parable. He's saying, look, you know what's valuable in life? And you know that if you've got valuable possessions and you lose a valuable possession, what do? You go and you find the valuable possession. And the audience will be nodding their head and say, that's right, we value possessions. He looks and he says, and moves in from the wide open fields, comes into the family home. And he says, how about money? If you've got money and you lost money, what would you do? Well, you'd go and find your lost money, wouldn't you? So he moves from the wide open fields into the home, from possessions to money. And now he moves into the absolute heart of God. And he says, well, what about people? If you would go out and you would search for a lost possession that you valued, and if you would go out and look for lost money that you valued, then would you not place a higher value on a lost person who was created and bears the image of God, who God loves and who God would die for? And you would want to welcome them home and find them. That's what's going on in this parable. One parable. It's getting it down to the point. Do we care about possessions and money more than we do other people? And Jesus tells a parable about one who is not prepared to write anyone off as lost. Not even one. It's a story about one who is desperate to see every last person restored to the love of God. And notice, I kept the first verse of this story in. The story starts, or the setting of this encounter starts, and the Pharisees and the religious leaders ask the question, who is this one who eats with sinners? And Jesus looks at them. It's much worse than you think. Not only do I eat with them, I search for them, and I am desperate to find them. I stand at the gate and look and run down the road shamelessly to embrace them and to restore the marks of sonship or daughtership on them, to invite everyone to celebrate with me in the joy of this homecoming. You see, the scandal of this parable that Jesus tells, it's found in that third part of the parable where we find out that the older brother hasn't gone and searched for the lost brother, the one that thought he was the one that was doing the right things, the religious, good moralist, would find a possession, would find money, but would not move an ounce to go and find a lost person. That's the scandal of this story. Didn't even go and look. Who is this person that eats with sinners? Well, that's the good news of the gospel, isn't it? Jesus is the true older brother. The brother we need who's prepared to pay the cost to seek and save what's been lost. And Jesus is the one who leaves the Father. Jesus is the one who experiences true exile, who's stripped and left naked and in shame so that we can be robed in his garments and have our shame covered. He's rejected and cast out, so we're accepted and welcomed in. And he pays the cost so we can freely receive. And he knew no sin, but became sin so we can be forgiven. That's the good news of the gospel. And he bears the judgment of the world so we can receive the mercy of the Father. I wonder if you experience that mercy. That's the wager, isn't it? Is God good? Is life found in God, or is God somehow holding something back where life and identity and purpose and meaning is found outside? And what Jesus is coming to is to show us what God is like. You can know what God is like. God is knowable and has made himself in a way that we can see in human form to walk among us. We can know what God is like. It's revealed in Jesus. And the length that God would go to bring you home, to bring me home, to find a place at the table. And the invite for everybody to experience the joy of homecoming. There's three responses I just want to think about. And again, I'll share just a little bit of testimony with them. I think things that we communities that create communities, just to think about how I might work that out, I guess, exhortation or my thoughts of mission and ministry out of this. The first one is that I think we have to recognize the sacredness of the encounter with the stranger or the newcomer. Treat the visit of the stranger or the newcomer as a sacred moment. You just think about that time before I turned up to church. What had gone on? My grandmother had been praying probably for 20 years. My parents, God, Lord, how much sleep did I cost them? How much prayer had gone in and how much anxiety had been spilled to think about their desire for me to know the love of God in which they'd raised me to know. What had it taken for my sister and her now husband to give up this Friday and Saturday nights that they could have gone with their friends, and they came to a place that probably wasn't their thing, and they sacrificed that to come to me in the bar and to meet me there. You know, so when you invite someone to church, that's often not an easy thing. I wish it was. I wish it'd be easy, but there's a sense of, oh, what will this do to my relationship with this person? You know that. That's behind the visit of the stranger to any one of our ministries or to a Sunday morning. To think about what was going on for that person. For me, what happened after that I went along a couple of times and then I stopped. It was, anyway, long story. My older sister came to faith and she just started inviting me every single week. She probably invited me 10 or 11 times to church. Have you ever invited someone and persevered and made that welcome known to them 10, 11 times? Well, you know how hard it is to invite the person once. You think, well, I've done it, Lord. I tried to Alpha, you know, inviting, and well, I tried, and they said no. And yet, you think about all that going on, the prayers of my grandma, the prayers and anxieties of my parents, the invite of my sister, the sacrifice of them, the other prayers and the multiple invitations of my sister and a stranger, me, now turns up wondering, boy, what are they going to think of me? I tell you, they... might be an overshare, but my sister used to have to cross all the way across town to pick me up because I was in no fit state to drive from the night before. And she would eventually she'd start carrying neutralizing spray and she would spray me down because I reeked of booze. It dragged me in the church. You think about what's the stranger going through? When a stranger walks in this door one morning, what is their life story? What are the prayers that have been going on? What are the courage that it's taken from others and for them to that moment? You'd better believe, and we'd better hold, family, that that is a sacred moment when a stranger is in our midst. Sacred moment. Our gatherings are to be a place of homecoming, of joy and encounter, not just like any community, because anyone can create a shadow community. Communities that create communities. CrossFit can do that. You know, we'll find it somewhere. I'm talking about not the shadow, the community formed on Jesus and at the table of the Lord. Sacred moment. Make it a homecoming. Just note in there as well, Jesus eating with sinners doesn't mean he affirms everything about them. My sister was not affirming of everything I was doing. She shouldn't have been. But that didn't stop her from inviting me to a place at the table at that point. What Jesus does, it doesn't mean he affirms everything about everyone that he invites. After all, he's calling us all to repentance, to turn back to God. But what Jesus does, he comes in such close proximity with them that they have an opportunity face to face to experience the love and the grace of God in a way that that love is such that it transforms us. It requires closeness and proximity. And that's what Jesus was doing and what we're called to do. Another experience, one Sunday night, I got a phone call from the church sexton and he had a friend of a friend rang up that was in an unsafe situation. It was 10:30 on a Sunday night and he rang me up and said, hey, I've got a friend in great need. Can I send her around? So Karen, we'd already prayed. We didn't have kids at the time. We had a spare room and it was sort of like, okay, that's the Lord. So we said, sure, send her around. We sat down and we had yarns and it turned out that this woman was a prostitute and she was in charge and oversaw the largest brothel in the country. She was discipling other people into that. She was a multiplying discipler. And I wasn't expecting that story. But we were sitting there and we were talking and chatting away and we got to know more of the reason. It turned out her entry into that was her husband had cheated on her and she was so broken and so hurt by it and impacted. She wanted to find a way into the male mind as to why would someone do that? And one road led her to another and yet opened up and wasn't affirming that, but we were affirming the person and giving her a place at the table. And the next morning, after lots of listening and conversations, Kara was up and just reading in John's Gospel, sat down and read John's Gospel alongside her and just got to encounter Jesus at the table in a safe place and proximity to meet Jesus. She came to a few weeks later, it was an evening service, and were preaching and sharing the story, invited to respond to God's invite. And this young boy walked up and had just been moved. And it was her son. It's a story. It's not for us to change. It's not for us to judge. But to allow people a place at the table, a word in the table, where they can encounter the grace and the love of God and a sense of homecoming. Yeah? The stranger's sacred moment. All of life is a homecoming, an encounter with Jesus. Moving on, the other thing I would say is, not projecting this, I think that you guys have this gift of hospitality, so this is an encouragement to it. Friendly isn't enough. In an isolated world, friendly is the lowest possible bar. People, when they're coming, they are looking for friends, not friendly. Pick the difference? Our churches, of course, they should be friendly, but the covenant love of God is one that actually takes responsibility for that love and for the welcome of others as well. Friendly is not enough. We're looking for friendship. It's interesting, after I did come to faith, and I was genuine about my response to the gospel, but what that had meant is that on Friday and Saturday nights, I didn't want to live the way that I used to live. Like, genuinely, there'd been this, not out of rule-keeping, I just didn't want to live that life anymore, and yet I had no friends. Because the friends that I had, plenty, that involved that. I didn't want to, so I'm coming along to church on a Sunday morning, but I had nothing else to do on a Friday and Saturday night. I was lonely. Lonely. And so I got the friendliness, and the first conversation's always easy, but what about the second? What about the invite to something? What about friendship? And without that, I drifted back, and I didn't want to be lonely. And one day I was Sunday afternoon, and I was just finishing the book that I was writing, and I'm just praying, crying out to God. I said, I can't do this. I actually want to walk with you. I know you're the source of life, but I actually can't do this alone. And I wrote down in my journal, I said, God, I need friends. Would you answer that prayer? Because I can't do it alone. Well, I walked into church that night, and I was greeted at the doors we do. And this day was something different. I always got a friendly welcome. And this day, girl, Raywin was on. And Raywin saw me coming, and she said, oh, hey, Chris, hey, come and let me show you to a seat. And she's come and sit down and sit beside Mike. And I was a bit late because I wasn't even Anglican. I must have been prepping for it or something, eh? But I was late, and I came and sat down beside Mike. And Mike would say in worship, the whole service, the Spirit was just saying to him, you need to connect with the God. And he listened to the Spirit. Anyway, he invited me to catch up. We went out and had a coffee. He ended up being my groomsman. The guy we met up with ended up the best man, and they invited me to move in with them with a group of five other Christian men, and I kind of got to watch and see how they walked with Jesus and how they dated and just what a life walking with Jesus might look like. It went from friendly to friendship. Last one, I know I'm probably long again, and maybe finish with one more little point. I notice in Luke 15, this parable that Jesus tells, or this encounter, it comes straight after another one that he taught on the great banquet. And the great banquet's the story of this king who invites people into this great feast to know this joy and this bountiful provision. And others say, well, look, I'm too busy with my possessions, or I've got my money, I can't come. You know, it's the connection to earlier. What's more important? Anyway, he says, well, look, the banquet's ready. Just go out and go out to the lanes and the highways and the byways, and you compel people in. And when they come back, and there's still more seats. There's always more seats at this table. And so to be communities, forming communities, is to be communities of homecoming and the joy of that encounter with the one who is love. And as we come in, we experience in some way homecoming. It's a bit like breathing. We breathe in and we come into God, and God says, breathe out and go back out again. Because there's always more room at the table. Always more room. We need to go where the people are. I finish with one of the other most profound encounters in my life. I was coming outside of the church one night, walking home, and encountered a man who... He was struggling with addictions and various other struggles in life as well. And we chatted, and we said, well, let's go get a meal together. So walking, I said, where would you like to go? And he said, oh, KFC. Just said McDonald's for the sake of the story, but he went to KFC. And we're walking along, and it's a dark night, and we're walking towards, and there's bright, shiny, sparkling white KFC. We walked closer. He looked and stopped and said, "Oh, I can't actually go in there. I'm not able to go in there." I didn't know why. And I was like, oh. I said, "Okay, I'll go. What do you want? I'll go in and I'll bring it to you." And it came out, and my friend Jimmy was sitting in the gutter on the side of the road. I said, "Okay." So he came up with me. I just sat down beside him in the gutter there, and we shared a meal. And suddenly I went home. I thought at this point that I was the hero of that story. I came home and was praying. And God said, "Whatever you do for the stranger, the one without, you do it for me." Things with the hospitality of God and the stranger, it's that in hospitality, the stranger is where we encounter God. And it's this great promise. And God showed me this picture of this was this place. I mean, it wasn't KFC, but this glory, the love of the Father, my inability to be there. And this great story of our great older brother who would give it all, who would come out and come to us in whatever we were doing and wherever we were, into the depths, even to the gutter, to bring us a taste of the banquet. You know, what I found is that this life, it doesn't just change everything around. There are still struggles. You know, this grace doesn't transport us all the way to the end and make everything rich and rosy. Sometimes we still know the pain and the struggle and that tension of not fully knowing love. But there is this promise that Jesus brings us, is that Jesus is with us always and will be present and will lead us to that home. And when we gather in this moment of homecoming, we gather around the table, which Jesus shows us is the banquet of all of humanity and God's love, of his death and his resurrection and his welcome and the promises, his presence, and the encouragement for us to be communities that give a foretaste and a signpost of this great homecoming that we receive in God, and as a witness to others. So hold that as we come to the table, the love of God, the pursuit of Jesus, who comes to find you and then sends us back out, knowing that there's always more space at the table.